Thing I want to do is offer an apology, because I know some of you are probably here exclusively to see Paul Pellizzari, who was billed as the moderator. Unfortunately, Paul was stuck by an organizational travel ban in Florida, and so was not able to join us. So at the last minute, you got another Paul, which is me, Paul Smith. I have an independent consulting service called Sustainable Gaming in the space of responsible gambling. And I've been asked to fill in on Paul's behalf. I hope I will do him justice, and certainly our three great panelists that we have lined up for this afternoon. So without further ado, I want to call them up now and ask them, when they are seated, to introduce themselves. So come on up, fellas.
Different chair.
It's still just as warm. Welcome, everybody. So just to be blunt, I'm going to ask you, each of you, to tell us why you're here by way of introducing us to your backgrounds and, for those that don't know, kind of your particular interest in this topic.
Luke? Shall I go first? Sure. I just thought I'd hang around for this session. I'm a professor at UBC. I direct the Center for Gambling Research. I've spent 15 or so years doing research around what we talk about as the person-product interaction. So how do personal vulnerabilities, risk factors for gambling harms, interact with the games themselves? So what are the differences between different gambling products, and what are the specific features of products like EGMs that contribute to harms? And we see it very much as an interplay between those two sets of factors taking place within the wider gambling environment.
Sure. So Darren Jang, Senior Manager for Products at BCLC. So basically, I'm in product management. We basically look after making sure we're putting out the most entertaining products we can out there. But at the same time, you know, player health is becoming more and more top of mind. And I think one of the reasons I'm here and why I've been asked to contribute at this panel is just bringing my perspectives. Because in the last session that we talked about on what are we trying to measure and what are we trying to prevent, you know, it was very clear that obviously the tools and the techniques that we use in marketing and in product management, those same tools can be used as well in preventing harm. So I think in bringing my aspects there, I think that's what I can do to kind of help in this whole discussion.
There we go. I started my PhD in 2000.
Must be your pocket.
Even here.
Brilliant. So I think you got by now, I started my PhD in 2000.
And it was specifically looking at the structural characteristics of what we have in the UK for machines.
Over the next 12 years, most of my time working in at the time
the two main gambling research centers, along with one
Luke was working in, again studying wide ranges of gambling behavior, but with a specific interest in game design. After that, I then moved to the Responsible Gambling Trust, which is now referred to as GambleAware. You're probably familiar with it, where I was director of research. And that was really interesting because that was right at a very contentious time when gaming machines were at the top of the list for something that had to change. And I don't know how much of it was discussed over here, but the big issue was, well, how do you change it? A lot of the issues that we're still dealing with now. And that was interesting because you've seen the political complexity, the conflict of interest that I hadn't realized occurred, which is the conflict of interest between different sectors of the industry. And then in from 2014, I've just very similar to Judith, I've set up my own fairly small research consultancy doing research and some training. But most of my interest at the minute is being guided back towards game design.
Jonathan, maybe while we've got you there, I'll start you off with a general question to all three of you. In your view, what are the biggest misconceptions that we have related to the impact of gambling product versus features at risk? And I'm starting with you because obviously that ties right into your paper and the conversation from this morning.
Yes, and on that basis, it's actually very difficult to pick one. And there's a long list of them in the paper. What I felt, I guess it does still answer your question, but I think it's a very important point, and I didn't get to explain it in enough detail, at least, in the presentation. And it hits right on this cusp between risk and entertainment. And I don't know if we can talk about it as part of this session, but it's going back to the issue of demand-led versus supply-led. And to tell you what I mean, so if metaphors in gambling are a terrible mix, I think, but I think one of the ones that's quite helpful is if you think of bungee jumping. Bungee jumping satisfies a certain psychological need. And you can modify the jump itself, or you can modify and protect using the things around the bungee jump. So the metaphor is, are we looking to reduce, to do it in a dull room that, and have it 5 meters long? Or are we able, because in, and I was looking at this when I couldn't sleep last night, I was trying to Google how many people die from bungee jumping, and it's ridiculously hard to find an answer to that. But the point is, they get the surrounding measures right, because they have to. And I think it's a very important point, and there's two reasons why. The first reason is, at least in my view, it is incredibly complex to understand what makes not only the features, but how they come together. That's one thing, as a product. Second thing is, how do they, and this was brought up earlier, how do they influence risk at different stages of the individual's experience with gambling? And then, and particularly drawing on Luke's work, how does it interact with the player? And our knowledge gaps just fall right off the cliff at that point. And then I think even when we start to answer that question, you're still left with the dilemma. When you modify risk, I think, not all the time, and that's why choice architecture, I kind of probably spent too much time talking about that today, but that's a great example where there's probably minimal, if not you'll increase entertainment by making it right. But I think things like the near miss, I do think probably will be shown to be potentially addictive, particularly to some individuals, but also contribute substantially to the enjoyment of the game. So going back to my point, so you have these two things that I'm still, and I have to be, I mean, it's an area that I'm very much interested in. And as more interest develops, I'm getting more work. But I still very much believe that, and it's a big if they can take action on things like we talked about earlier, like the identification, the appropriate interventions, and I believe that we know enough to make a difference, then we shouldn't have to. And I go back, I'm reluctant, but I'll go back to the apple fritter analogy. That it'd be great, and to be honest, I can walk and have one apple fritter, but the point is, you modify the apple fritter, well, let's make it the worst tasting apple fritter ever. And there's stuff, some out there, I believe, where there's no sugar, no trans fats. I think I tried a Reese's Pieces buttercup from Whole Foods my first trip. Anyway, I'm getting off topic. And so that's the point. And it's highly contentious, and particularly for me saying it, because, and this is an issue growing everywhere, and I think it's relevant to this debate as well, somebody who works with industry saying you shouldn't screw around with a product, it's very difficult. But for me, it seems like common sense. And let me just give you one example, and it was raised, and it's probably going to come up in terms of payment. One of the things with the £2 stake argument, and so very, very quick history to this, was that in the UK, we had machines very similar to VLTs. They were easily accessible in bookmakers on the high street, very close to where people lived, and they were very addictive, very high risk for lots of different reasons. Now, what had happened, in my view, is that a range of other competing operators who didn't have those machines together with people who quite rightly were concerned, got together for a campaign. And the campaign was limited to the two-pound steak. Now, we don't have time for me to get into why I didn't think that was the right idea, but just to give you one example, and it gets back to Judith's very important points about payment. In the UK, in those environments, you could use a debit card. You could pull out your debit card, and you could hand it to the... And these are very small environments, by the way. It's not like a casino where basically you'd be a member of staff. And I can just say, hey, Paul, load me up another £200. Now, for me, and again, it's a long, detailed argument, but I think, depending on your position, that there's some logic to it. That seemed like a very sensible approach, alternative approach to reducing the stake size. And one thing I should say is that the thing about stake size was it only applied to a certain category of game on the terminal. And that was very slow. It was like a roulette wheel. So you could almost lose as much on the slots on that terminal, which weren't targeted, because they were every few seconds. But of course, the proponents of the £2 stake had £2 machines that were really fast, so they didn't want to touch those. So in amongst that cynicism is the very real issue that it's incredibly difficult, but things like the remote loading that I was talking about in terms of payment, which we all agree is one of those things that still needs to be tackled, allowing people to spend money they didn't intend to spend. That's a great example, because that's not really modifying the game, that's modifying the controls around it. So I think that's one of the most contentious, and whether it's a misconception or not, I know it's one of those things that I think is central to the stuff that we're trying to talk about, particularly when we're looking at what's entertaining. And don't get me wrong, it doesn't really affect me if the gambling industry stopped tomorrow. But I think we all have to be very clear, particularly policymakers, are you banning a product by virtue of making it unplayable? And if that's so, at least be very clear that that's what you're doing.
Darren, you have any thoughts?
Sure, yeah. I think my mic's good to go. So I think one of the misconceptions with trying to put some protection around product features is that it's the games are, they're all very unique. And you can't label a game as, hey, these games are near-miss games and these ones are all losses disguised as wins, if I'm getting all those terminologies correct. And because there's actually, I've seen over my time the evolution of games and how they've evolved, and the fact that games come in and out of fashion. So to then say, hey, these set of features of this game, this is maybe what may be causing some harm, it will then evolve again and become something else. And these trends are always constantly changing. The near-miss concept itself has probably been around for 20, 30 years. It's just constantly evolved. And it's really hard to... Pinnon, I can kind of draw you the map of how it's evolved over the time, but I think just as a misconception to say something is static in a product feature, like an apple fritter maybe, would be false. So that's one thing we need to be conscientious of, and as well that to the point of that product where if you do change something, it does affect the flavor, it does affect the ride. In fact, you could take two games that are cloned in their mathematics. So the volatility, the losses, guys' wins, all these things, they are identical. But then you changed subtle things like the graphics or the theme, all of a sudden the performance difference is drastically different, even though all the other variables are controlled for. So just trying to say that there's quite a bit of depth to games that a lot of people don't understand, and I think that presents some of the challenges that we're facing today.
Fair enough. Luke?
I would focus on that as well. I've heard video game designers talk about that as the juice, that kind of unknown essence of where the game comes from. In my lab, we call this supra additivity, which is a word I really like, but it basically just means that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. And what that is really saying is that most of the research that's been done on product features is looking one ingredient at a time. So if you focus on speed, as Jonathan talked about this morning, do gamblers like faster games, and does the speed act sort of disproportionately on people with gambling problems? you can say audiovisual feedback. Do gamblers respond to audiovisual feedback in the game? Do problem gamblers respond disproportionately? And you can go feature by feature doing those experiments. But these are so complex as products that there are many, many dimensions like that. The other possibility is that all of those ingredients come together in the game to create perhaps a game that is highly immersive, a game that just kind of absorbs the player. And that immersiveness is not a simple consequence of any one of those ingredients. It's the whole, but it's the immersiveness that leads the gambler to lose track of, you know, the appointment that they were supposed to be at or spend too much money. And it's the immersiveness that might be particularly correlated with gambling problems. So for me, this is a sort of fundamental thing that we need to understand in order to figure out how to regulate product features.
Stern, I want to come back to you just for a second, and the others might have comments based on your answer, but what are you looking for when you are acquiring new games? Do you just wait and see what games are successful in the marketplace somewhere else and say, well, if that one's doing really well, we'll take it? Or do you make decisions based on what you perceive to be the right combination of the right secret sauce ingredients for the BC market, or some combination of the two?
Sure. It's probably more the former than the latter, though. I would say maybe in the early days before analytics got sophisticated, it was probably more of the, hey, kind of this looks kind of cool. It has the ingredients that our players are looking for, so let's try and get it out there. Not to digress too much, but there was one vendor we were looking at, and they were... all our games in those days were just pick 'em style bonuses. So you get in the bonus round, and you're trying to pick and reveal prizes until you get a Terminator, and then you're out of the bonus. And this vendor had brought the concept of free spins. And, you know, it was new in the marketplace, and I said, free spins? Nobody wants free spins. It's all about pick 'em bonuses. And boy, was I wrong, because that vendor took off like a rocket, and now every game practically has some sort of free spins bonus element. So, you know, we try and take a lot of the guesswork out of it. We do rely on a lot of reports on what's doing well in the marketplace. We have our test banks, we have our trial banks, so we're constantly testing and trialing out there before we then purchase out in wider scale.
And have either of you gentlemen had any kind of experience or insight into identifying what is going to be a successful game, or understanding why it's successful versus less successful? Luke, or you've got some machines in your lab.
I don't. We look at the immersion as the sort of net result of that. But I know you can look at some games that have very similar, mathematics. The game that's basically running on the same platform with a different skin, and it can have a different appeal to players. It's a perplexing thing.
I think that's part of it. It's like I said, I think that the overlap is much greater than we realize between what makes it risky and what makes it fun and enjoyable.
Yeah.
Let me give you a contentious example. There's been a lot of research on dissociation and the broader motivation for detachment, particularly even in relation to gaming machines, is by far the most highly correlated to problem gambling. So what would happen if we were to allow dissociation for 20 minutes? Just as a theoretical question. If there was enough controls around it that you could stop it. You know, there's somebody who's totally very high levels of arousal, you know, negative arousal. And there's something that they can do in an affordable way that takes them away from it. Because the problem, for example, with dissociation, as we know, is that you continue to gamble for long periods of time and it escalates, particularly when the panic sets in, when the financial implications, the motivation changes from the experience of playing to, right, I need to get my money back or pay for my wedding or whatever it is that they need to do. So, again, it's just it's such a challenging area for all those reasons. I think the second point to make, and I really appreciate what these guys are saying in terms of the super additive. I always love
secret
Luke.
Sauce. Yeah.
Luke always comes up with the best technical terms. Great. I think we also have to, and maybe Darren has an answer for this, but we also have to be aware of is that difference in performance in relation to harmful play? Or is it because it's being called Marvel Avengers, it's attracting more of the leisure spend? And again, you may have data on that, I don't know. But again, just that extra level of complexity.
Sophistication, yeah. Mm. Yeah. Darren, a lot of operators are starting to become very cautious, and certainly BCLC is the case, very conscious of incorporating social responsibility into their mandate and their approach to doing business. Question for you personally, have you ever felt pressures from that side of the business to back off or change decisions about how you've purchased games for the marketplace here?
I don't think I've ever felt pressure in that sense. I remember when we started with responsible gaming, and it was kind of like this new kid on the block, and we were trying to adapt to what this new kid wanted, and it took a bit of time and adjustment, obviously. And sure, there would be those conversations where we're not quite sure exactly what you're trying to get at and do. But I think it's evolved over time, as a lot of the earlier sessions have talked about, where it's starting to be much more of a collaboration and partnership. And so, just to give you an example, we also try and answer one of Jonathan's questions around the data, is we took a look at this one game called Lightning Zap, and this game does not have reels. It basically just has a depiction of a lightning rod, and as you press the button, a lightning will go up the rod, and it may then zap the prizes available or not. So unlike in a traditional reel spin where you'll see the animation play out, there may be some effects, and then the game's over. This thing was pretty much done in like less than a second. So you press the button, lightning zapped, and wind went back down. And so there were concerns coming from the player health group that, hey, this is raising some red flags. So, typical response maybe 10 years ago was, hey, we know the business, other jurisdictions are playing this game, so we're just going to prove it and just put it on the marketplace. But no, we actually took that seriously. So we said, hey, let's let the data prove it. So we took our player carded data, ran that against the game. I said, I want to know how these people are playing the game. So we analyzed, speed. So how fast are they playing? Because the concern is they're going to get carried away, they're going to play this game, and they think they are just going to go at it, and they think they're going to win, and they have a chance of winning because of their skill of how fast they can pound this button, right? And so when we looked at it, we did see that the games played per minute was faster than the average game, and we benchmarked it against a number of games that we had that had an average bet range similar to this game. So it was faster. I think on the number of sessions played, number of games played per session was about 20% more. But the interesting factor was that they spent less time on it. So it was about a third less time than on other games. On other games, they spent about 8 minutes, 9 minutes. On this game, it was only 6 minutes. So they played faster, but they spent less time on it. The net spend per session was $7, where on average it was $8. So looking at that on a whole, we couldn't say that this product was more harmful than all our other products, because there wasn't any information for them to suggest to us that is that more harmful or less harmful. So what we decided to do in a collaboration effort was to produce some literature that would then be posted at the game that actually say, this lightning rod piece, like, it doesn't matter how fast you press it, it has no bearing on the results. There's no skill in this game whatsoever, that every chance is random, and that doesn't matter what you did the spin before, that the spin after has no bearing from the past spin. So I think that's a really good example of how we're just collaborating better as an organization with player health, with the businesses, on then really evaluating our products and make sure we're just doing the right thing.
I think it's fascinating. It's another illustration of how complex the analysis can get to actually inform decisions. And then coming back to your point, what were they trying to get to? What, presumably the agreed target was to reduce the over-involvement of people into the game, and yet we found that the game that was deemed most risky was less risky than its counterparts. I may be oversimplifying, but that seems like what you were trying to say.
Yeah, pretty much exactly. Like it's, and that's the thing that, and could be some of the misconceptions too, is that You know, what we think, based on all the research out there, it would be lend itself to think that a particular product is risky may not actually be once you study the actual data of what how players are reacting to it. Mm-hmm. And I think the other factor to think about, too, is that players don't always just play one game. Given that I saw the average session's time was 8 minutes, and I know that players on average spend about an hour and a half in a casino, and other data that from players saying that they will jump around to 10 to 12 games, and it will also depend on their wallet size. So someone with a bigger wallet size, they'll be able to afford to play more games. So there's a lot of variables going on there.
Yeah, for sure. I'm going to just pause for a second, and maybe we can take one or two questions from the audience, if there are any there.
I was just wondering about...
Just wait for a microphone, if you don't mind. Thanks, Jamie. Hopefully it'll work.
I was just wondering...
Hello?
There we go.
I was just wondering about when you're looking at the analytics for the Lightning Bolt game, does it tell you about their wins and losses in those 7 minutes and whether they stay longer if they're winning and just get out if they're not? Do you have that in there?
No, so we didn't particularly look at that. We could have, but our concern was really around whether what do we do about this product? That was the main concern. We didn't look at from a player level, right down to the 177 players that were carded that we could see, what were their responses, reactions individually, because also the concern is too then, you know, it brings into some things around the privacy piece that was just talked about, privacy side. What if we know some things, what do we do with this information? So that's another aspect that we didn't want to wade into. And the fact that on the carded data, we only have, you know, just slightly under 50% of track play. So then there's a whole other bunch of untracked play that we don't know. So we don't want to make too many assumptions, given that the amount of information or limited information that we have.
It's maybe worth saying there that a lot of this logic around product features in general assumes that these effects are going to be linear. So if we're thinking about speed of play, and Jonathan made this point this morning, how fast is too fast, and we're just assuming there that because a 10-second slot machine is not as appealing as a 5-second slot machine, that if you get right down to 1 second, it's going to be kind of dynamite. But for near misses, there's a classic paper showing that these effects are not linear at all. There are kind of sweet spots. So this study compared a game with a 15% rate of near misses against a 30% rate against a 45% rate of near misses. It's the 30% condition where you get the persistence. And there's a very recent paper in the last 6 months or so from the Waterloo group showing the same kind of sweet spot for losses disguised as wins as well, that it's not a really high rate of these things that is powerful. There's a sweet spot in the middle. So we need to build that into our thinking, and there can be some false assumptions at work here.
Maybe we can go to the app and see if there are any questions coming in on the screen.
Perfect. So we have one question right now on Slido. The question is, do you think additional risk transparency could help bring balance to gaming? For example, money spent or time play counters or anything along those lines on screen while playing?
Jonathan, I was going to ask you a question similar to that. That's the whole issue of what do we know for sure about features that can reduce risk?
So this, if I've understood the question correctly, it's not that you're directly modifying the game, but what in the proximity of the game might have an impact. Is that correct?
Yeah.
As the game is being played and they're spinning and it's saying you've been playing for X amount of time and having a money spent versus how much money has won or how much money they've won and showing that comparison, so that way folks are actually having a real-time understanding of how much money is going into the game and how much money is actually coming out and into their pockets. So,
I think it's a good question. I think when you look at the research on feedback generally, transparency on expenditure, my understanding is that it's helpful, but only a little bit, particularly within the session, because one thing that we do know is how, and particularly Luke, how the brain, how we think, how we regulate our emotions changes when you gamble. And I think in that situation where they are chasing losses, they don't feel great. And one of the most interesting things about studying product is it's very cyclical, because quite often it will draw people who want to escape. And then it can create emotions that make you want to escape. And so the short answer to your question, I guess, is that I think it will have some impact, and I don't think it would be a game changer, for a pun. And I think but you raise a very important point, that one of the big challenges for all of us, and it's not often talked about, is this issue of efficiency. We have a finite amount of resources, and I think increasingly that's more time than investment. I think the money's there to invest. It's about, well, where should we focus our efforts? And it's a big question, particularly around product. What's going to work? And this is why the point raised by Tim earlier about sharing best practice, particularly from the industry. And I think traditionally one of the things that happened in the UK in the early, around 2012, 2013, is that they were trialing things and they weren't working, but they were concealing it. And they weren't sharing it because they thought if it was a failure, in some cases, it was hopeless anyway. So, for example, the initial Association for British Bookmakers, they did a pop-up when you hit your limit, but you could just click a button right away and keep playing. So, but there's some really good stuff that's going on that's not really being documented, evaluated, and even if it's not thoroughly evaluated, even if you can start sharing and disseminating it, it helps with those discussion points about where should we focus our efforts in making meaningful, as Judith says earlier, we're not going to solve everything with a silver bullet. That's something that we know from a long time now. But where can we, in terms of the time it takes to develop, in terms of evaluating, get the most value from that interaction? But I think it would definitely help.
Yeah, we do have Play Planner deployed currently, and so if you're familiar with that, then that does allow the customer the option to set time and budget limits. The challenge is that they can just easily just swipe those away. But I don't have this, unless someone can help me, the stats on our registration rate. I know our registration rate's not that high, and we don't make it mandatory. And so there's some debate around that. What I do know is we did introduce some games that we had customized with mandatory time limits and play limits. The challenge was is because it was only those games and players generally found it annoying, they tended not to play those games. So they became our worst performing games on the floor, and so then from a business standpoint, we can't afford to really keep them. So, you know, it becomes a bit of a challenge. And so I think that's where Play Planner, we're using the system to override and overlay on top of the game, which is probably a much better solution than trying to get all the games themselves to actually have that feature embedded, which is quite a bit challenging given that, you know, we're one jurisdiction, and for us to ask the vendors to take every game and modify it for just our jurisdiction becomes a very expensive proposition. So, and that's the thing too, like we don't have as much influence to change games as much, right? We really just buy sort of what's off the shelf with some, you know, BC specific requirements, but it can't be too onerous on the coding, because if we're the only ones asking and no other jurisdiction is asking, then it becomes very expensive or very limited in the content we can bring to the market.
I want to ask a question that this came to mind. I'm going off script. Sorry, Luke. And that is, I find it frustrating sometimes as someone who's done responsible gambling program oversight and design that a lot of people react to our RG initiatives as if they're intended to stop all problem gamblers from spending more time or money. And I've always had the belief that responsible gambling is targeted at not high-risk players, but at mid-
thing I want to do is offer an apology, because I know some of you are probably here exclusively to see Paul Pelizzari, who was billed as the moderator. Unfortunately, Paul was stuck by an organizational travel ban in Florida, and so was not able to join us. So at the last minute, you got another Paul, which is me, Paul Smith. I have an independent consulting service called Sustainable Gaming in the space of responsible gambling. And I've been asked to fill in on Paul's behalf. I hope I will do him justice and certainly our three great panelists that we have lined up for this afternoon. So without further ado, I want to call them up now and ask them when they are seated to introduce themselves. So come on up, fellas.
I'm going to take a different chair.
It's still just as warm. Welcome, everybody. So just to be blunt, I'm going to ask you, each of you, to tell us why you're here by way of introducing us to your backgrounds and, for those that don't know, kind of your particular interest in this topic. Luke?
Shall I go first?
Sure.
I just thought I'd hang around for this session. I'm a professor at UBC. I direct the Center for Gambling Research. I've spent 15 or so years doing research around what we talk about as the person-product interaction. So how do personal vulnerabilities, risk factors for gambling harms, interact with the games themselves? So what are the differences between different gambling products? And what are the specific features of products like EGMs that contribute to harms? And we see it very much as an interplay between those two sets of factors taking place within the wider gambling environment.
Sure. So Darren Jang, Senior Manager for Products at BCLC. So basically, I'm in product management. We basically look after making sure we're putting out the most entertaining products we can out there. But at the same time, you know, player health is becoming more and more top of mind. And I think one of the reasons I'm here and why I've been asked to contribute at this panel is just bringing my perspectives. Because in the last session that we talked about on what are we trying to measure and what are we trying to prevent, you know, it was very clear that obviously the tools and the techniques that we use in marketing and in product management, those same tools can be used as well in preventing harm. So I think in bringing my aspects there, I think that's what I can do to kind of help in this whole discussion.
I guess a quick 20-second bio. I mean, I started my PhD in 2000.
Do you want me to write my hand up?
There we go. I started my PhD in 2000.
Must be your pocket.
I'm even here. Brilliant. So I think you got by now, I started my PhD in 2000. And it was specifically looking at the structural characteristics of what we have in the UK fruit machines. Over the next 12 years, I spent most of my time working in at the time, the two main gambling research centers, along with one Luke was working in, studying wide ranges of gambling behavior, but with a specific interest in game design. After that, I then moved to the Responsible Gambling Trust, which is now referred to as GamblerWare. You're probably familiar with it, where I was director of research. And that was really interesting because that was right at a very contentious time when gaming machines were at the top of the list for something that had to change. And I don't know how much of it was discussed over here, but the big issue was, well, how do you change it? A lot of the issues that we're still dealing with now. And that was interesting because you've seen the political complexity, the conflict of interest that I hadn't realized occurred, which is the conflict of interest between different sectors of the industry. And then in from 2014, I've just very similar to Judith, I've set up my own fairly small research consultancy, doing research and some training. But most of my interest at the minute is being guided back towards game design.
Jonathan, maybe while we've got you there, I'll start you off with a general question to all three of you. In your view, what are the biggest misconceptions that we have related to the impact of gambling product versus features at risk? And I'm starting with you because obviously that ties right into your paper and the conversation from this morning.
Yes, and on that basis, it's actually very difficult to pick one. And there's a long list of them in the paper. What I felt, I guess it does still answer your question, but I think it's a very important point, and I didn't get to explain it in enough detail, at least, in the presentation. And it hits right on this cusp between risk and entertainment. And I don't know if we can talk about it as part of this session, but it's going back to the issue of demand-led versus supply-led. And to tell you what I mean, so metaphors in gambling are a terrible mix, I think, but I think one of the ones that's quite helpful is if you think of bungee jumping. Bungee jumping satisfies a certain psychological need. And you can modify the jump itself, or you can modify and protect using the things around the bungee jump. So the metaphor is, are we looking to reduce, to do it in a dull room that, and have it 5 meters long? Or are we able, because and I was looking at this when I couldn't sleep last night, I was trying to Google how many people die from bungee jumping, and it's ridiculously hard to find an answer to that. But the point is, they get the surrounding measures right, because they have to. And I think it's a very important point, and there's two reasons why. The first reason is, at least in my view, it is incredibly complex to understand what makes not only the features, but how they come together. That's one thing, as a product. Second thing is, how do they, and this was brought up earlier, how do they influence risk at different stages of the individual's experience with gambling? And then, and particularly drawing on Luke's work, how does it interact with the player? And our knowledge gaps just fall right off the cliff at that point. And then I think even when we start to answer that question, you're still left with the dilemma. When you modify risk, I think, not all the time, and that's why choice architecture, I kind of probably spent too much time talking about that today, but that's a great example where there's probably minimal, if not you'll increase entertainment by making it right. But I think things like the near miss, I do think probably will be shown to be potentially addictive, particularly to some individuals, but also contribute substantially to the enjoyment of the game. So going back to my point, so you have these two things that I'm still, and I have to be, I mean, it's an area that I'm very much interested in. And as more interest develops, I'm getting more work. But I still very much believe that, and it's a big if they can take action on things like we talked about earlier, like the identification, the appropriate interventions, and I believe that we know enough to make a difference, then we shouldn't have to. And I go back, I'm reluctant, but I'll go back to the apple fritter analogy. That it'd be great, and to be honest, I can walk and have one apple fritter, but the point is, you modify the apple fritter, well, let's make it the worst tasting apple fritter ever. And there's stuff, some out there, I believe, where there's no sugar, no trans fats. I think I tried a Reese's Pieces Buttercup from Whole Foods my first trip. Anyway, I'm getting off topic. And so that's the point. And it's highly contentious, and particularly for me saying it, because, and this is an issue growing everywhere, and I think it's relevant to this debate as well, somebody who works with industry saying you shouldn't screw around with a product, it's very difficult. But for me, it seems like common sense. And let me just give you one example, and it was raised, and it's probably going to come up in terms of payment. One of the things with the £2 stake argument, and so very, very quick history to this, was that in the UK, we had machines very similar to VLTs. They were easily accessible in bookmakers on the high street, very close to where people lived, and they were very addictive, very high risk for lots of different reasons. Now, what had happened, in my view, is that a range of other competing operators who didn't have those machines together with people who quite rightly were concerned, got together for a campaign. And the campaign was limited to the two-pound stake. Now, we don't have time for me to get into why I didn't think that was the right idea, but just to give you one example, and it gets back to Judith's very important points about payment. In the UK, in those environments, you could use a debit card. You could pull out your debit card, and you could hand it to the... And these are very small environments, by the way. It's not like a casino where basically you'd be a member of staff. And I can just say, hey, Paul, load me up another £200. Now, for me, and again, it's a long, detailed argument, but I think, depending on your position, that there's some logic to it. That seemed like a very sensible approach, alternative approach to reducing the stake size. And one thing I should say is that one of the thing about stake size was it only applied to a certain category of game on the terminal. And that was very slow. It was like a roulette wheel. So you could almost lose as much on the slots on that terminal, which weren't targeted, because they were every few seconds. But of course, the proponents of the £2 stake had £2 machines that were really fast, so they didn't want to touch those. So in amongst that cynicism is the very real issue that it's incredibly difficult, but things like the remote loading that I was talking about in terms of payment, which we all agree is one of those things that still needs to be tackled, allowing people to spend money they didn't intend to spend. That's a great example, because that's not really modifying the game, that's modifying the controls around it. So I think that's one of the most contentious, and whether it's a misconception or not, I know it's one of those things I think is central to the stuff that we're trying to talk about, particularly when we're looking at what's entertaining. And don't get me wrong, it doesn't really affect me if the gambling industry stopped tomorrow. But I think we all have to be very clear, particularly policymakers, are you banning a product by virtue of making it unplayable? And if that's so, at least be very clear that that's what you're doing.
Darren, you have any thoughts?
Sure, yeah. I think my mic's good to go. So I think one of the misconceptions with like trying to put some protection around product features is that it's the games are, they're all very unique, and you can't label a game as, hey, these games are like near-miss games, and these ones are all like losses disguised as wins, if I'm getting all those terminologies correct.